This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. University of Alabama Professor Emeritus John Boland says that fixing long-term systemic problems with poverty requires addressing a shortage of hope first. Boland will speak on Tuesday at Western Michigan University. His address is titled Expecting Poverty and Violence: How Expectations Shape Underclass Youth. John Boland, thank you very much for being with us.
Certainly.
So when you talk about addressing that shortage of hope, what causes that to begin with, and how do you get at it if you're going to fix some of these problems of poverty and violence in urban areas?
One study that we did looked at several things that predicted feelings of hopelessness. And I should say that those feelings of hopelessness are really quite high in the inner city neighborhoods that we studied. Just by way of comparison, the levels of hopelessness that we found were about 4 to 5 times higher than what is found in typical studies of hopelessness in middle class areas. It is roughly 2 to 3 times higher than what other people have found for adolescents who are emotionally troubled and receiving counseling. And it's almost 75% as high as for middle-class adolescents who have been institutionalized because they've tried to commit suicide.
And what areas are you studying specifically? Where is this data coming from?
This is from a number of neighborhoods in Mobile, Alabama, and its neighboring city, Pritchard, Alabama.
And this is the Mobile Youth Survey, which you conducted over many years, correct?
That is correct.
So tell us some more things that you found from this survey, and what did it tell you about the conditions that people are living in and what their expectations are?
Okay. First off, we looked at predictors of feelings of hopelessness, and two things stood out, really. One was lack of connectedness, that people who felt that they weren't connected to their neighborhood, to religion, to other institutions, tended to feel more hopeless than those who were connected. And second, adolescents who had experienced disruption in their lives were more likely to feel hopeless. So those are two things that would likely predict hopelessness and that I would see as ways of trying to change levels of hopelessness, to improve connectedness and to reduce disruption in people's lives.
The youth survey work started when? About 2000?
1998. We received funding from the City of Mobile and the Mobile Housing Board and the City of Pritchard to conduct a survey of youths just to try to get some idea of what the conditions were. And we brought a number of students, probably 12 students from the University of Alabama, down to Mobile for the summer, and we went out and interviewed probably about 1,700, almost 1,800 youths from the lowest income neighborhoods in Mobile. And just kind of an indication of the poverty level, according to the 1990 census, these neighborhoods had a poverty rate of over 70%, and the median household income in these neighborhoods was right at $5,000.
Did you find any significant change over time? Did the situation get better? Did it get worse, or did it stay about the same?
It depends on which things we were looking at, but one interesting result that we did find, we looked at what happened after Obama was elected, because Obama's message of hope was important and really addressed what we were looking at. Probably just as important, the election of an African-American president may well have been an important symbolic factor for these African-American youth. Probably 98% of the 99% of the youth that we interviewed were either African-American or mixed race, African-American or Caucasian. And what we found was that after Obama's election, there was actually a reduction in hopelessness. There was an improvement in self-worth, and there was an improvement in the expectations that people had for their futures.
Is there some danger, I wonder, though, in the idea of pinning hopes on the one person who kind of stands out in a crowd? You know, there are always stories of one person who escapes poverty. And I'm wondering if those perhaps give some false hope and maybe also put people who are in a position to address it in public policy where they might say, hey, look, President Obama is elected president. Obviously, we've solved race and we don't have racial problems in America anymore. We don't need to deal with them. Is there some danger in sort of the one exception to the rule?
Yes, certainly. I think, though, that a finding that a lot of scholars have pointed to is that a strong racial identity among youths tends to be a protective factor, protect them against a lot of the risky behaviors that they might engage in. But that notion of racial identity, and this is something we're just exploring now, so I don't have any definitive answers. But that notion of racial identity, I think, is lacking in a lot of the most impoverished neighborhoods, that instead of feeling a sense of racial oneness and the importance of being African-American, what happens in a lot of these neighborhoods is that that identity becomes replaced by a kind of street ethos that might exist. And what we found was that this street ethos, which might be reflected in beliefs like, if you don't carry a weapon in my neighborhood, something bad might happen to you, or if somebody starts a fight with me, I'm going to finish it. That notion of that there's violence all around and I have to be prepared for the violence and I will engage in violence myself if I need to reduce the risk to myself. That tendency, I think, is predominant in a lot of these neighborhoods, and therefore the racial identity, which might be a protective factor, simply gets overwhelmed by this street ethos, or what sociologist Elijah Anderson called the code of the street. So it may be that the election of a black president created a sense of racial identity that may not have existed before, and who knows how long it will last. It's not necessarily a lasting thing, but it certainly seemed to have an impact, at least in the short term, and I'm talking about a four-year period, on the hopelessness and the self-worth of the youths who were living in the neighborhoods that we did study.
Have you found anything else which helps get at hopelessness? Are there other things, perhaps public policy changes or something that perhaps nonprofit groups have done, which get at the issue of hopelessness in these very poor urban areas?
I think a large issue is that most of the programs that have been developed in an attempt to address feelings of hopelessness or other risk factors at an individual level. I know that we receive funding for a substance abuse treatment program in these neighborhoods from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration in Washington. And we were required to kind of focus on individual substance abuse treatment issues, meaning do kind of cognitive behavioral therapy with individuals. And my belief is that regardless of how good the treatment program is, if it is the neighborhood that is creating the risk, then trying to fix an individual but keep them living in the same neighborhood isn't going to be very effective. And that you really have to do something to try to change the neighborhood. And I think that's critical. Again, go to this street code idea. If people believe that the neighborhood is dangerous, trying to convince them not to carry a gun or another weapon isn't going to be very effective because it would put them at risk. And I even question whether it would be ethically viable to try to convince kids not to carry weapons in an environment where they may get hurt if they don't carry weapons. So the only thing that you can do is try to change the environment, try to change the neighborhood, rather than trying to change the individual but leave the environment the same.
In other words, if the neighborhood truly is unsafe, trying to convince people that it is probably not, at the end of the day, a very effective prescription. Another, you have to make the neighborhood somewhat safer in order to get people thinking that it's okay and they can walk the streets relatively assured that there's not going to be a problem. Is that what we're trying to get at here with making people feel better about the neighborhood they live in?
That's right. Just trying to get them to feel better about themselves or feel better about the neighborhood without changing the environment. Now, there's a reason they don't feel good about themselves, and that is largely because they're living in a really difficult environment, and that has an effect on the individual and how the individual feels. So trying to change the individual without addressing the environment is just not going to be very effective, I believe.
Is there, I guess I'm wondering as well, is there a chicken and egg factor here, and perhaps maybe a lagging indicator? In other words, even if you do make the neighborhood somewhat safer, will there still be a perception that it is not? And do you have to make sure that the perception at some point does catch up with reality and ensure that that people don't do things in a way which protects them from dangers which are not as great as they believe they are?
Certainly. And, you know, our question is, how can you change the neighborhood without changing the behavior of individuals within the neighborhood? And certainly that's an issue. But one of the things that I think could be effective is trying to change. Remember, I talked earlier about that feelings of connectedness tended to reduce feelings of hopelessness.
Right.
And so how do you increase the level of connectedness that exists? One of the things that we have found in all of our studies is that there really isn't much trust that exists among residents in these neighborhoods. People, youths and adults even, don't really talk about friends so much as talking about associates. I was talking with a woman in a public housing neighborhood, and she explained to me that she was living in public housing. I didn't even ask the question, but she said that she was living in public housing because her husband left her, and then maybe her car broke down and a couple of other things happened, and she had no option but to move into public housing. But she looked around. We were outside. She was hanging clothes while I was talking with her. She looked around and said, but most of these other people, they're here just because they're lazy. Now, I think if you went next door, you would hear exactly the same story, that the person who you were talking to next door was there because of a set of circumstances that created a financial burden and that they had no choice but to move into public housing. But again, that person's belief might very well be that everybody else was lazy. So there's a perception that exists that's largely in American society, that people are poor because they don't want to work hard, or they're poor because they're lazy, or they're poor because they lack some important quality that is associated with success. The United States is really almost unique among developed countries in that perception, and it's so widespread in the United States that it even goes down to the level of people who are actually living in poverty have bought into that same notion, that people are living in poverty because of some personality flaw or personal flaw, but they individually are different. And I think that if you can create an opportunity for people to really get to know each other in a safe setting, they will discover that, yes, they have many things in common with their neighbors. And you really have the sense or the ability then to begin to create a sense of community. And I think that that sense of community is critical to be able to put the needs of the neighborhood ahead of the needs of the individual.
I'm wondering about the students who you have working on this youth survey, and do their perceptions of why people end up in poverty and what some of the solutions are change over time as they meet these people and perhaps learn their stories about what happened to them along the way? Does that also do something for the students who might not come from this same background themselves?
Yes, absolutely. One of the things that I tell the students, I'm talking in the present tense, but the study has been over now for a couple of years, but we had a week of training at the beginning of each summer, and I would tell the students that if they knew less about poverty when they went home than they did when they came, that it would be an entirely successful experience. In other words, a lot of the preconceptions that they had and a lot of the understandings that they had were probably overly simplistic, and that poverty and the creation of poverty and the effects of poverty are much more complicated than they really understood, and that by being out with these individuals, they would develop a better understanding of what the circumstances were that created their individual situations, and a better understanding that there's no easy fix to address the problem. So I think that the students really were sympathetic to the idea of low-income people trying to get by and sympathetic to their situations, but they really didn't understand the complexity of those situations.
John Boland, thank you very much for your time.
Certainly. Enjoyed it.
John Boland is Professor Emeritus at the University of Alabama. He will speak on Tuesday at Western Michigan University. You can find a link with more details at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.